Accession number 21095, reel 24.
It's hard to know where to start. I was not involved in any shape or form in the ABM treaty, which has become such a challenge now because of the National Missile Defense Project that the Americans are promoting. But I wrote about the ABM treaty, and after President Reagan proclaimed announced his Star Wars project, which after all was the first and an even bigger attempt to create a missile defense system, the ABM treaty was very much involved then, because missile defense would clearly violate the treaty. And so I started writing about the treaty and its implications and so on. But I did not report on the actual negotiation of the treaty, which was the earliest big nuclear arms control measure. That I came in, I think, at the tail end of the SALT I agreement, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that President Nixon negotiated in 1974. That was my first trip to Moscow. I came on the White House plane, and I think I've talked about that before. And I remember Henry Kissinger giving a press conference in the night tub of the hotel where we were all staying. Again, I think I was just there at the time when it was concluded, and again, I had not been reporting on it, and I think I knew very little about it in those days. Where I really sort of started reporting intensively was on the INF treaties, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, which of course was hugely contentious and which was suspended at various times, which dealt with the issue of medium-range nuclear missiles deployed in Germany and, of course, their Russian counterparts, CDU movement in Germany, of course, was very powerful in those days. The whole issue of the deployment of American medium-range nuclear missiles on German territory almost brought Germany into a civil war situation, and certainly, I'm exaggerating, but the opposition was very, very strong indeed. And
it would be the Pershing.
Yes, the Pershings and the... Oh, God, what were the others?
Cruz and
the Pershings. Thank you very much. Yes, the Cruz and the Pershings, and God, I wrote endlessly about all of that. And I remember there was one time when the East Germans, when the GDR announced a major withdrawal of Soviet forces stationed in the GDR as part of its attempt to convince West Germany that there was absolutely no justification for deploying the Cruz and Pershing missiles in West Germany, and this was their sort of counter move. And I think Brezhnev made a big speech in East Berlin making that announcement, and the GDR government invited Western journalists to witness the withdrawals, and we were taken to I can't remember where we were taken. I'd have to look that up. We were taken to Martin Luther's birthplace, where in the GDR. I remember it was associated with Martin Luther. We were taken by train to that city, to that town. And then we were at the railway station, Wittgenstein. It was Wittgenstein, I think. Yes. Yes, we were taken to Wittgenstein. I have to check that, but I think it was that. And we were taken to watch the departure of some Soviet forces. But in their sort of utter stupidity, neither the Russians nor the GDR had realized that by taking us to see this, we would also observe the conditions in which the Soviet forces were being withdrawn. And we saw the ordinary soldiers being put into what were really cattle trucks and just sealed into those cattle trucks, and then we saw the officers striding onto the platform in their magnificent uniforms and going to sit in the first class carriages. So of course we reported that aspect of it as well, and you know the sorry state in which the ordinary soldiers were, just the way, you know, their uniforms and so on and so forth. Anyway, it didn't convince anyone that there was a really major force withdrawal underway, nor did it please the GDR or Soviet authorities that we all made sort of rather snide comments on the way in which these forces, whichever they were, for all we knew, they were simply being exchanged for fresh contingents, were being taken out of the GDR. But that was a sort of little sidebar to what really was a very emotive issue. And the West German government of the time was defending the deployment of the Pershings and the cruise missiles, but of course it put them into considerable political difficulties as well. And the INF negotiations were suspended for a long time because of the deployment. And then gradually the discussion started again about verification, first of all, of Soviet missile withdrawals from forward territories, from communist bloc countries, which they claimed they were prepared to do, or were making, and of course again from Germany. And from German territory, though, of course, because they weren't all in Germany, of course, they were deployed, of course, in Britain. We had Greenham. They were in the Netherlands. And I can't recall anymore in all the countries where they were, but in all those countries, there was resistance to having them because they all felt exposed to Soviet attack because of that, but particularly in Germany. And then gradually, as they decided to resume the negotiations, the discussions focused on verification. There was the famous incident of the walk in the woods between the chief American negotiator, Paul, and the chief Soviet negotiator, Mr. Yuri Kuczynski. This was later turned into a play that we saw on the London stage. But at some stage, those two men did a walk in the woods and they found a formula that paved the way to resolving the deadlock in the arms negotiations. And eventually, we had our first INF treaty. And I wish I could recall, I really have to look up some of my own articles, or at least to look up the history of the period, to remind myself of all the ins and outs and what Douglas Hurd always used to call the nooks and crannies of the negotiations, because it's somewhat misty in my mind. And again, I can't quite remember at what stage our attention shifted from INF to the START negotiations, the strategic arms reduction talks. But of course, they came to dominate the superpower nuclear arms negotiations, especially already before the famous Reykjavik summit, but much more so after the Reykjavik summit, where Gorbachev and President Reagan almost agreed to scrap all long-range nuclear or strategic nuclear arms. The Reykjavik summit was a traumatic event for everybody who was there. The whole event has been reconstructed in a documentary film, which is probably the most accurate all-round picture of what really took place, and a lot of it at the time none of us knew. It was done by Brian Lapping, and it's something that certainly should be in the Holocaust, in the Imperial War Museum as in its archives. It was a quite remarkable reconstruction based, I happen to know, very largely on information provided by Richard Pearl, who was then the Undersecretary for Defense in the Pentagon for the United States. I mean, he provided, I know, a great deal of the information on which it was based, though there were other sources involved, naturally, including Soviet sources. But for those of us on the periphery at the time, Reykjavik sort of remains a jumble of extraordinary impressions. At first, of course, we knew very little of what was going on. I mean, clearly it was important that it was happening. It was after Reagan's Evil Empire speech, and it was the first meeting that the two men had had. I mean, it was the first U.S.-Soviet summit since the since the Evil Empire speech. And Gorbachev, from the moment he came to power, had been pressing for major strategic arms reductions. He made the Soviets had made all manner of proposals in Geneva, many of which I've covered. Incidentally, just to go back to the first Geneva summit between Reagan and Gorbachev, that was in Geneva. They got on quite well on that occasion. And as it happened, Reagan was staying in a house owned by the, or anyway occupied, I think it was rented by the Aga Khan. And the Aga Khan's family moved out for the duration of the summit. And one of his sons, who was quite small in those days, had asked the Americans in particular, he said he was terribly concerned about the goldfish, that they should be properly fed. So Reagan allegedly did some feeding himself. Anyway, that was one of the little sidebars that we were reporting from that summit. And come back to Reykjavik, most major Western papers had at least two or three correspondents there, one to cover the Soviet side, one to cover the American side, one to sort of write color and so on and so forth. I think The Guardian had, I think we were only two, we had Michael White, who was the chief political editor of The Guardian, who was writing sort of color pieces, he had been Washington correspondent as well, so he maybe he was still there as Washington correspondent. Anyway, there were the two of us there, and I remember while the summit was going on, all of us were trying to interview Raisa Gorbachev just to give us something to do, and I tried to follow her around, couldn't get into the American pool that had been set up. And then somebody said she was coming to visit one of these pools in Reykjavik where they had hot water springs and where people, you know, were swimming even in the middle of the winter. So a couple of us decided to go and swim. And we sort of leapt at Mrs. Gorbachev when she came in and confronted her. got a few sentences out of her. But that was a novel way of trying to accost somebody. But then
she seemed a very charismatic lady.
She was very diffident at first. And I think at that stage she was still very, very diffident. But later she sort of blossomed. But she was never that outgoing, no. She was always rather, well, probably shy, but also not very sure of herself. But I think that improved later. I mean, I think gradually they all learn. But I think at that stage she was still were quite hesitant and not much pleased by being sort of followed around by all these Western journalists trying to get her to say something. But anyway, then, you know, as we knew the summit was nearing its end, you know, one always gets terribly restive waiting for the signal that it's finally over. And I had managed to get a, because you had to apply for places at the various press conferences, I'd managed to get a place for the Soviet press conference. And we were very much on deadline at that stage. And the trouble about those press conferences, once you're in, it's extremely difficult to get out again. And so I went to Gorbachev's press conference, and he started, and he gave a point-by-point account of what had happened, from his point of view at least. And it went on for, I mean, he spoke for at least 40 minutes. And then it was question and answers, and I think I got a question as well, which pleased me greatly. But anyway, it was just going on and on and on. And you know, he was telling us these extraordinary things, that he'd offered the complete elimination of nuclear weapons, and at first there seemed to have been agreement, and then the Americans went back on what they had said, and so on and so forth. And it was terribly exciting, but you couldn't leave it because you weren't sure what else he was going to say. And then there was this sort of mad dash for the press rooms where the telephones were, because in those days we were all still operating with telephones. I mean, this was pre-computer. And then, you know, I had to find my colleague Michael White to see what he'd gleaned from the Americans, who, I mean, the Americans were sort of almost weeping at their press conferences because they felt that they had utterly failed in what they had set out to achieve. And, you know, we had to try and interpret all this, and it was not easy. And, you know, I remember flying back the next morning and feeling, you know, that the world had missed a sort of huge change in the way the superpowers would deal with each other, and had missed a prospect of genuine nuclear disarmament. It, you know, we didn't. I think it took us who were there much longer to understand that, in a way, that Reykjavik had been a setback, and that what had been on offer had been, you know, as Mrs. Thatcher saw it, a trap for President Reagan, and that Gorbachev had come with an offer that could never have been accepted, and that rather than promoting arms control negotiations, it had set them back. And of course, Mrs. Thatcher was extremely negative about what had taken place at Reykjavik, and very quickly tried to educate President Reagan into understanding the enormity of what he had only just escaped. But
so she was realistic, you felt?
No, I don't think she was realistic. I mean, look, I suppose, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, what was discussed at Reykjavik never really was on the cards, but I certainly think it meant a great deal more, that there was a far more positive content to what the Russians had brought there than NATO was afterwards prepared to accept. I think progress could have been made on the basis of what Gorbachev said, and you know, it took a long time before things got going again, and before the two superpowers then began to look more realistically at ways of achieving substantial cuts, or at least halting the arms race in long-range and nuclear missiles, because you know, for a long time the arms control negotiations were less about cuts than about just stopping the addition of missiles and warheads and all the rest of it, and it was becoming quite obvious after Reykjavik that part of the American establishment, part of the American administration, was convinced that they had to bleed that they had to maintain the arms race in order to bleed the Soviet Union to the extent that the system might possibly collapse. And in a way, that is what happens. But I think there was one school in Washington which clearly was consciously bent on doing this, while others saw the relationship and the arms control negotiations still mainly as a, if you like, technical issue. How do you create a halt to nuclear weapons, to the nuclear weapons race? How do you achieve cuts in nuclear weapons without endangering security? How do you verify to ensure that you still maintain the kind of balance which they were trying to maintain? I'm being very superficial in what I'm saying, and I think a lot of this requires a great deal more rethinking than I've done recently on all these issues. But I think with the wisdom of hindsight, there's no doubt that the Richard Perls of this world, who really did believe in bleeding the Soviet Union as much as possible, in exhausting their resources, in forcing them to focus on arms production, on nuclear weapons production, rather than on the civilian economy, that was a major contributory factor that then eventually led to the implosion of the Soviet Union. So you can argue in retrospect that they were right to do this. At the time, it certainly seemed to me a questionable way of trying to deal with the superpower relationship. For the most time, the strategic arms reduction negotiations were held in Geneva, though at times they shifted to Vienna. I would go from time to time, usually because they used to negotiate for 2 or 3 months at a time and then suspend the talks for a while and then come back again. I would usually go to Geneva at the point when they reopened it again, when they ended, to try and sum up what was going on. In the process, one got to know some of the Soviet negotiators as well as the American negotiators. And they were interesting people, and some of them talked relatively freely, though of course all of what was going on was shrouded in secrecy, because the issues were clearly delicate, since they were not only very important high-level negotiations, but because they dealt with nuclear weapons, where neither side wanted to give away very much of what they had. It became an interesting process, and one always. I always enjoyed the occasions, though at the time they were always terribly nerve-wracking. And when I think of the hours that we used to spend standing outside the American mission to the United Nations in Geneva, where the talks were held when they were held on American territory, or outside the Soviet embassy when they were held in the Soviet embassy in Geneva, it required a lot of patience. And then finally, when it got to the point where they concluded or had begun, and then there would inevitably be an American press conference, much more rarely a Soviet press conference, but they did take place from time to time. We would dash to the Intercontinental Hotel, where the Americans were always staying, and where they had their press conferences, and where they had press rooms, and so on and so forth. So, we knew all the routines, but you always had to wait, and usually it was always on deadline. Nothing ever happened at a time of the day when you could then sit down at leisure and write. And of course that was very hard, because you had very little time in which to interpret and explain whatever it was that was being announced and discussed. But somehow I suppose we managed, and there was always the day after. Every superpower summit during this whole period, I've already talked about Reykjavik, but I haven't talked at all about Brezhnev, because after all, the the start to the SALT II treaty was signed by Brezhnev and Carter in Vienna, and that the culmination of that treaty was very exciting, because they still had to negotiate one or two clauses right up to the last moment of that treaty. I had come to Vienna straight from Warsaw, because I'd been covering the Polish president. I'd been covering the Pope's, I think, first or second trip to Poland after he'd been made Pope. And we'd all been used to seeing these huge crowds, millions, and suddenly there we were in Vienna, just a small crowd outside the Austrian Chancellor's office where the treaty was being concluded. And we were allowed in then for the actual signing ceremony. We were taken into the Redoutensaal in Vienna, which that was before it burned down, and this is a beautiful chamber in the Imperial Palace in the Hofburg. And Brezhnev sort of tottered in and supported by Gromyko, and you know, scarcely able to walk, and Carter, you know, looking very fresh and bouncy, and Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador to Washington, was there, and Brezhnev always had this habit of giving everybody a bear hug, and Carter, who most certainly did not want to be bear hugged, was standing there waiting to shake his hand. And Dobrynin told afterwards that he said that in an interview much later, that he had said to Gromyko, "I bet you he's going to try and embrace Carter," and Gromyko said, "No, never." And then, of course, Brezhnev tottered up to Carter and embraced him on both cheeks, and Carter looked extremely embarrassed. And then Brezhnev was scarcely able to read out the speech that he had to make. I mean, at that point, he was really you just felt there was some kind of a machine standing there, but and he was quite obviously not very much aware of his surroundings or what he was doing. And you sometimes wondered whether it was just a wax figure which had been brought there to sign this thing. But anyway, the treaty was signed, and that was a major event. That was at the time when Carter and when we were all forever writing about Amy, the Carter daughter who was being dragged around everywhere. And I remember I went on an excursion on the Danube with Mrs. Carter and Amy, visiting various places just for something to do. And this child really was quite obnoxious, and his mother, I think, was there as well. I met Carter's mother properly later on in Paris once, and she really was a sort of rather formidable old lady, and he was very attached to his mother, Carter. Well, he was very attached to his wife and his daughter as well, but the mother was a sort of special factor in his life, and she was still being trundled around as well, I think, in those days. The SALT II treaty really was a landmark treaty, because I think that really that was the end of the because it really marked a qualitative and quantitative cut in strategic nuclear arms. Later, of course, we had the START treaties that went much further. But without the SALT treaties, we would never have got to the START treaties. And I don't know whether without Reykjavik we would have got as much as the START treaties afterwards achieved. The momentum had been created.